Okay, well, we're here today with Hensworth Jonas. He's preaching at our church today, and he's from the East Caribbean Baptist Mission and the preaching elder there. And I've heard him preach several times, both in person and live, and I have always been greatly edified. But one of the things that I really like to do is not just listen to the sermon, but understand God's workings in the man behind the sermon. And so thank you for coming here today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. So I want to begin by simply asking you, how did you come to know the Lord?
I was a little boy going to a Baptist church on the island of Antigua. Baptists have only been on the island for since the early 60s. So it's even though Baptists have been in the Caribbean as well, over 200 years and more.
Wow.
But my mother was a charter member of the church. My father, my late father, was an Anglican, nominal kind of. But and I grew up in the church, but there one day a missionary pastor from Alabama was preaching. And for the first time, I began to understand what was being said, that I was a sinner in need of the grace of God. And he was more of the Armenian type a preacher, and he asked us to come down the aisle, and I obeyed and committed my life to Christ in a childish kind of way. Later on, I began to learn the implications of what it means to be a disciple of Christ, you know, and sought to commit myself more fully to that. I was baptized in 1970.
Wow.
All right, and pretty much grew up in the church. I took piano lessons, so I played the instruments in church, piano and organ, and went through high school, and our church got, for the first time, a national pastor. The missionaries pastored for 20 years of the church's mm-hmm. life. And he was from another island, though. He was not from my country. And he took me under his wing. He became my friend. And the thing about it that the Lord used was that he allowed me into his study at his home. And I was just fascinated with the theology books. I just couldn't get enough of it.
Wow.
And I just kept going back just to get into his study and to check out all these books. And God lit a fire in me for his truth in that experience. I was also concerned, Baptists being pretty young on the island, the quality of our ministry. I heard mocking statements about the ignorance of our preachers and pastors. The missionaries at the time were in a hurry to build their records, so they put men up who were not trained. Maybe they had a one-year Bible course, some of them, you know. And in a developing country where academics was becoming more and more important and speaking well, and so I was very much ashamed of it and was complaining one time, you know, about the kind of people, you know, some of them are barely high school graduates that they were putting in the pulpit and so on. And my pastor in disgust looked at me and said, "But what about you? Maybe you're the one to do something about this." You know, and that pretty much stuck with me. I couldn't get that out of my head. Maybe I am the one who is to preach the gospel. Hmm. And God used that.
How old were you at that time?
I was like 17, 18, wow. You know, and later on, he was able to help me get into Oklahoma Baptist University. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that, I went on to seminary, one of the Southern Baptist seminaries, and well, actually at Southwestern.
That's where I went.
In Fort Worth. But almost immediately, he had resigned. And there was a vacancy in the pulpit there. And I'd finished OBU, a Bible degree there. And they said, "You're the only one abroad. You need to consider coming home and pastoring the church." You know, I was single, just with a college degree, one semester of seminary. But I always said, America doesn't need another preacher. I need to go home and grab this opportunity because, you know, and so yeah. I did just that. And so I left seminary and went home with the idea that I'll come back later and do it. I went home to a whole lot of trouble. You know, the prophet is not without honor except in his own country.
Yeah.
A lot of the folks saw me grow up and just didn't give me a chance, you know. And I went to OBU. It was not necessarily a conservative school at the time. It was more center, left a little, you know. Mm-hmm. But I became a conservative.
Amen.
Somehow, in all of that, I wasn't buying all the stuff they made us read, the new Orthodox theologians right. and all of that stuff. And I went home and lost my best friend. I also found out at Southwestern, took a systematic theology course, and they used the 3-volume Millard Erickson mm-hmm. Christian Theology, which is a mild Calvinism.
Right.
And especially the chapters on predestination really got to me. So when I got back home, I'm looking in the mirror and saying, "You're a Calvinist, you know. But I've never seen or heard anyone preach the doctrines of grace."
Wow.
I had not seen it at all. So I was in the closet, if you know what I mean. I knew this was trouble. And I decided that after a few years to ask for a sabbatical to go back to do some more seminary. Mm-hmm. And I chose Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary mm-hmm. in Kansas City. I chose it because a former OBU president, Milton Ferguson, was there. I had no idea what I was doing. I took my wife and little boy, 2 years old, and we went to Kansas City, Missouri. And my first class, I realized I was in trouble. It was a spiritual formations class. Hmm. And I'm expecting us to discuss the spiritual disciplines. And the professor got up and said, "Well, I know what you all are expecting, but I'm going to teach what helped me in my personal life as a minister. And it's transactional analysis, neo-Freudian."
You're kidding.
I remember two guys got up, walked out, went back to the seminary housing, and it was later in the day that we understood what happened. They walked out because he said that, packed up their families, left, and never came back. Of course, I didn't have that option. My home is in the West Indies. So I stayed out the year, you know, but I told my wife, I'm in the wrong place.
Now, what year was that?
It's like 1989.
Yeah, things are different.
I know, much different, much different now. It's a wonderful place now. Yeah. They even have the Spurgeon Library.
Yes, they
do. So I, that was pushing me back home. Something at home was pulling me. I left a SBC missionary in charge of the work. He's deceased now. For that sabbatical. And he proceeded to unravel everything that I had tried to establish. I had implemented biblical church discipline, you know, and he told them that is unloving. You know, and a lot of the people accepted this. This is a missionary with a doctorate from one of the Southern Baptist seminaries, and our young little pastor, what does he know? you know. And so I was losing my church. So I was told, you need to get back home. So after that, I went home, then I decided, well, you're already in trouble about to lose the church. You might as well just go public about your Reformed theology. And I did. Took home a bunch of 1689s and passed out to the leadership of the church. And all hell broke loose. The missionary was telling the folks, you know, we have some cults in Antigua, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons, and Calvinists are the newest one. You know, and
really?
Yes. And so, of course, I was able later on to counter a lot of that because we started a television ministry called the Sovereign Grace Hour, and the people saw the exposition of the Word of God and realized that they were not dealing with a cult. But
well, you had trial by fire.
Yes,
at the very beginning, didn't you?
The way, all the way. But the Lord enabled us to regain control of the work. I was able, by his grace, to lead the planting of two other churches and the founding of our Christian school, the Baptist Academy of Antigua, which has been a phenomenal success. I started with 11 children 27 years ago, and now we have 475 kids, K through 12. But the best part is both on the elementary and secondary levels, we have top test scores in our country for the last two decades. Wow. And so it's been a great witness, along with the television ministry, to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so, but the Lord has kept the work going and enabled me to continue to minister for his glory.
Well, what are the needs in your country and also in the greater Caribbean? What are the needs?
Well, America, sneezes, we catch the cold. The culture is really being influenced heavily by what's happening here. We have almost every religious expression as you have, and a lot of the same issues. Maybe we are a little bit slower in moving into the issues, but all of the issues that you have, we have. Okay, our island nation, twin island nation, would be more on the, we're still a third world country, but we're not the poverty like you would see like in Haiti and in many parts of Jamaica and so on, Trinidad and Guyana. We would be a little bit more affluent, not quite first world like America, right, but not poor. And so you will have life in many ways like the American experience in terms of the internet penetration, the cable television, and so pretty much people know what is going on. So a lot of the issues that you are dealing with, we are dealing with. The country is predominantly persons of African descent. The African diaspora, we had a slavery history just like America. The only difference is that we are the majority. So basically the white plantocracy was either bought out or run off, all right? Mm-hmm. The slaves later on formed trade unions and were able to pretty much lock down the plantocracy. And so our history is different in the sense that while it is still a coming out of slavery, persons like me grew up without the influence of a racial tension. Mm-hmm. Because it's pretty much, we run everything. We are the government, we are everything, you know. And right. So I tell people I found out I was a black man when I came to college in America. You know, because, I mean, in Antigua, I'm just a man.
Right.
You would be a white man.
Right.
But they will say that man. Up here, they will say that black man. You know, so we didn't have that kind of defensiveness that you would have in the African-American experience. because we were not fighting for any rights. We ran the place. Right. We still do.
I see the same when I go to Africa, mm-hmm. in many places, in Zambia and places like that.
But we can appreciate the African-American experience,
right.
and we do. And many Caribbean people interact with life. It's almost almost every Caribbean family has Americans, someone in America.
Yeah.
And many choose to live in Antigua and have dual citizenship. So the two countries, the two regions are inextricably linked in some way. So a lot of the problems are the same. And I'm finding, though, that there is still a sense of lostness due to the slavery experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the reasons why recently I'm thinking, when I got the opportunity to go to Africa and minister the word in Zambia, that it would be wonderful if we can connect truly reformed, Bible-believing Christians in Africa with the Caribbean experience, so that the African connection that the people long for could be profited from, especially if the individuals involved are truly Bible-centered people and are prepared to focus on Christ.
Well, we've talked about that, and I think that's a fantastic idea. And I've wanted to do the same here in the United States. I mean, God has raised up men like you in Africa also. You know, the Conrad Mbewe, the Ronald Kaufungwe, and so many of those men in Zambia and now also in Kenya, in South Africa. And I think that, you know, we need to see sometimes where is God working. And to me, it's not where there's a multitude of superficial evangelism. I look at where is God raising up elder qualified men of great integrity who are theologian, pastor, preachers. And that's one of the things I'm seeing in Africa.
You know, the people in the Caribbean revere the African roots.
Mm-hmm.
And the charismatics have been taking advantage of that. They're coming in and starting churches.
Right.
And Caribbean people are flocking to them to listen to them. They think it's a point of connection when, in fact, these people are snake oil religionists.
Right.
You know, and if we too can take advantage of that longing for that connection and involve, have a kind of cross-pollination going with godly people.
Let's give out, if Conrad Mbewe is watching this right now, or Ronald Kaufungwe, or Brother Chulwe up in the north of Zambia, I think you're hearing a Macedonian call, and maybe you need to listen, and we need to think about not just Africa, but also reaching
out. African diaspora.
That's right. That's right, and that's very biblical. That's what was going on in 1 Peter. Not African, but Jewish.
Yeah.
So talk to me about, you know, at Heartcry, we measure what's going on in a work by the strength of the local church and by the integrity of the elders. And what's going on in your area? Is God raising up men? Are those men, how are they being trained? What is the need in that area?
I could talk about my ministry first of all, which
right,
is just
absolutely.
A circuit of three congregations, three churches. And we have a five pastors, and two of them are my family. One is my son,
amen.
My 31-year-old son, and one is my son-in-law, that they're both now serving on our pastoral staff. And they did undergraduate degrees in American colleges, and did online training with Reformed Baptist Seminary
mm-hmm.
and Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, both Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Waldron.
Right.
And they are serving with me in that context. I happen to love the model. It's much better than what I did.
Right.
I believe it is more biblical in the sense that it keeps the trainee in the context of the local church, where the elders are their mentors and proctors, and all the technical right. subjects, the Greek and the Hebrew, are done with the PhDs at the seminary, with an online delivery system.
You know, I keep saying this over and over. Seminaries are good. They can be very, very helpful. But seminaries, they help the local church. They must help the local church. They can't take over for the local church. The local church is the incubator mm-hmm. where young men are trained to be in the ministry. And I think that is so very important. I was on a panel several months ago with a lot of mission people, and they kept saying, you know, the seminaries need to let the church get involved, or the mission organization needs to let the church get involved. And I stopped. I said, no, you guys have the tail wagging the dog. The local church lets you get involved. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so true. And that's what I like about Sam Waldron's ministry and Gonzalez and these ministries, is that they see that mm-hmm. and they're adding to the work of elders.
Well, when your elders are your mentors,
right,
reading with you, discussing with you,
right.
helping you with your studies, giving you opportunity to preach and teach and lead and to shadow them.
Right.
This is the best training,
right.
right? But there's another aspect to that kind of training that I found particularly interesting. I was talking to a young man who was a graduate of one of the Presbyterian seminaries, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is not speaking disparagingly of them, but what he described was horrifying. He said, we go clubbing and drinking on the weekends, you know, just like any other state school. And I just thought, if seminary was done in the context of the local church where you're under your elders, you won't have that kind of a problem where a person is so detached that they could be experimenting with this nonsense and living a duplicitous life.
Right.
You know, so the discipline, being under the discipline of local church elders, is crucial in the development of qualified men.
Well, especially in light of the non-negotiable qualifications of an elder.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them are character,
mm-hmm.
you know, apt to teach, but the rest are character, or have to do with their style of life. Is it conformed to sola scriptura? That's right.
I got a call from a young man some time ago. He told me he was in his final year, one more semester to graduate with an MDiv from a very noted Baptist seminary. Okay, and he and his family were coming on vacation to Antigua, and he'd like to know, what can I do? I want to do something. I said, no problem, man. Come on down. And I remember saying, it's around Christmas time. The Baptist Academy is going to have a Christmas program. There's going to be drama, some dance, some steel band music, and some other things. It's a program. It's not a service, you know. And I would like you to just take 15, 20 minutes and present the gospel to these children and their parents. Because, frankly, most of the people we serve are not believers. They come because of the academic excellence. So we're constantly presenting the gospel. They have to behave like believers when they are in school. So we're presenting the gospel at every opportunity we can, we do it. So, but I remember the young man sweating and just couldn't deliver. And I had to get up and rescue him and finish the job. Afterwards, I wanted to know, what happened? Are you feeling okay? You know what I mean? Is it a stomach bug or something? What happened? He said, Pastor, I didn't tell you, but I've only preached once.
Wow.
This is someone in their third year, about to graduate, and they had preached once. Once. And I thought, that model
doesn't work.
It's not right. You know, I have these youngsters of mine preaching every week.
Right.
And growing and learning and watching and, you know, and I just thought there's something wrong with that kind of model. And I think the significant factor is the detachment from the local church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that with all my heart. I believe that, you know, so often, you know, everyone today, or a lot of people, talk about being reformed. But I have found out that in most cases, it refers to a type of intellectual Calvinism.
Mm.
Reform, the Reformation was not founded upon Calvinism. It was founded upon sola scriptura. And looking at the New Testament church and asking ourselves the question, how did Christ command his stewards to care for his bride? And we don't have the right to invent or be creative. There's enough there to obey, to study and obey. And I think that's one of the problems. We have to look at what does the New Testament say about training men? And I think it's very, very clear. It's done by elders. As a matter of fact, I've come to the conviction that one of the primary ministries of the elder is the training of men. You know, 2 Timothy 2:2, entrust these things to faithful men. Since the 70s, we've come to believe, I believe erroneously, that that's referring to the multiplication of disciples. You know, every person in the church discipling somebody. But the fact of the matter is, in the context, he's talking about raising up elders.
Yes, and in many instances, what we have is the feeding of institutional monsters.
Right.
Once we have this setup, we feel the need to perpetuate it, right, when in fact the model is clearly not biblical.
Right.
And we need to courageously return the training of elders to pastors.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong in outsourcing technical issues, mm-hmm. You know, and I believe the online seminary is in the providence of God will help us solve that problem where the pastors and elders in the local church get that assistance.
Right.
But it should not be displaced by their biblical responsibility.
You know, brother, I have talked to some presidents of seminaries, and what's been amazing to me is that many of them would agree with everything that you've just said. But they'll tell me this. They'll say, pastors, send us young men that should never be sent to us, turn those young men over to us, and never get involved again until 3 or 4 years later when they supposedly go back to the church to get ordained or something. And some of the leading academics, you know, have told me, and I've heard them as a third party, say things like, you know, this is really a pastoral problem. And I think it is. I believe that if you were to look at who's the leader of the Great Commission, I mean, who are the men where you say the buck stops here? I believe it's the pastors of the local church.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is happening in a seminary or something is happening with young men that should not be happening, ultimately it comes back to the pastor.
Yes. He permitted it.
Right. And that, I believe that's why the elder qualifications are so important, because elders actually do have authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue. We've got to get back to the idea of a biblical pastor.
When I went to Zambia, you had a lot to do with that.
I couldn't. The first time I heard you preach, I thought, I got to get this man over to Zambia to be with Conrad and the other men.
Yeah. One of the things that I took back with me to Antigua was the need to mimic what they're doing, mm-hmm. in developing leadership with their internship programs,
right,
where young men come and shadow the pastors in their work, every aspect of their work, for a year or so, so they get a gist of what it means to run a church. And then they're sent out to plant a church with support from the sending church, but with a gradual cutting back,
right,
on that support to wean them off of it so that they are encouraged to develop self-supporting ministries, church ministries. And so, but that mentoring part, I never, but that's exactly what I'm doing with my own men,
right.
in mentoring
exactly.
them,
right.
you know, but I never thought that that I probably should open up
right.
and allow other persons to come in and look at our local churches, how they're functioning and
exactly.
how they operate and how we lead and, you know, how do you do your, what do you do in a day as a pastor?
Right.
Let them come around with me and, you know, and that sort of thing. That is the way to start planting churches, because church planting is the only real evangelism.
You're exactly right.
As much as I do the television ministry and have done so for nearly three decades, that's like an air war. You know, that softens up targets, but it doesn't take any ground.
Right.
You know, we need to invade on the ground still.
And church planting, you know, is hard. It's very, very difficult work. When you set out to plant a church, you have crossed the line with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be hard. It's one of the hardest things to do on the planet. One of the things I would like to point out is, you know, when I talk about what's going on in Zambia, what I can't stand to hear is when someone looks at that and goes, oh, that's a viable model because it works.
Mm.
And I'm going, no, you don't understand.
It's a
biblical model, whether it works or not. They didn't do this out of pragmatism. The men in Zambia came to these conclusions by simply studying the pastoral epistles.
Mm.
And I think, you know, everyone is so happy if we'll say something like this. Well, that's a model.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go so far as to say, no, that's the model. Godly men training godly men in the context of the local church and using. Because I bless God for academics, for Greek professors, for seminaries that hold to Scripture. But it's their assignment is to help, especially in these technical areas. I will tell young men this. Seminaries will not prepare you to be a man of God. That's not their job. But they will give you tools so that you can spend the rest of your life preparing. Church history, Greek, hermeneutics, things like that.
Well, you're so right, because without personal piety,
right.
all the areas of competence come to naught, come to nothing. There's one thing, though, that I want to point out about this going to Zambia and seeing this thing. It is a very important clarification that this is a biblical model and not based on pragmatism. But there is something so important about seeing it.
Yes.
I remember when I decided to go back home and correct things in my home and to come out in the open about my Reformed theology and whatnot. While I was at Kansas City, I had an itinerant ministry. I did in college, by the way. That's what God used to help me pay for college, because I only had money for one year. And I took a homiletics class, and the teacher, which was the dean of the School of Christian Service, thought that I was the most promising preacher in his class. So he decided to go against tradition. And that year, every year, they had a student chapel where a senior graduating ministerial student would preach. He had a sophomore, me, preach. And after that, almost every weekend, someone is calling me somewhere to preach for them. And it helped me get through the college bills. When I came back to the States to go to Kansas City, that picked up again. And I was invited to preach at a Baptist Student Union convention in the state of Arkansas, in Hot Springs. And on the way there, on the aircraft, I met this prominent pastor from Omaha, Nebraska, pastor of their largest church there, you know, mega church. And we found out we were both preaching at the same student convention. He liked what he heard from me there and invited me up to Omaha. and then invited his son-in-law over. His daughter was in college with me, and his son-in-law came over, and he was reformed. His father-in-law pastored this mega church, Armenian, and he pastored a little Reformed Baptist church, 75 people. Yeah. And they didn't get along because of theological reasons, you know. So at lunch, we're talking, and we found out that we have this in common, and we're kindred spirits, and we started talking about, what were you reading? Oh, I just got a copy of J.C. Ryle, Holiness, and then he started talking about this. His father-in-law leaves the room. He doesn't come back. Okay. So we're talking, you know. And so he invites me to come back to speak at his little church. And for the first time, I saw a Baptist church, Reformed, 1689, openly declaring the doctrines of grace. And I saw it, that emboldened me. Go home and do what you need to do.
Right.
Reform the church, you know. And so I saw it. Similar thing that happened there. I mean, in Zambia, you know, when I saw the mentoring,
yes,
and the possibilities for expanding the missionary enterprise in my region, mm-hmm, you know, was a beautiful thing. Sometimes you just have to see.
I go to so many, you know, there'll be a missions conference, and I'm very cautious with young people, very cautious, because I believe a missionary ought to be elder qualified and sent out by a local church, approved by elders, watched over by elders. And I'll see all these young people, they get fired up because of what some of the preachers are saying. Just go. The need is so great. Go, go. And they'll come to me a lot of times when I'm walking through the convention center or something, and they'll say, you know, I'm going to go. I'm going to go. I'm going to go immediately. And I'll say, I'm going to give you 5 minutes. Explain to me the doctrine of propitiation. And they don't know what that is. Okay, I'm going to give you 5 minutes. Talk to me about who should be ordained as an elder or a deacon and how you should go about it. And see, we're sending out all these young people, and it's not their fault. Bless their heart. They want to give their life for God. But we've got men who should know better. That's not telling them this. Look, if my 15-year-old son wants to be a brain surgeon, I don't put a scalpel in his head and lay somebody down on the bed. You know, he not only has to study, he has to see it. He has to see it. And it's the same way so many people have never been in a church. And I'm not talking about, you know, some radical, strange methodology, but just the simple, historic, biblical characteristics of a church. They've never even seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've got to change if we're going to change the Great Commission.
The fact of the matter is that a lot, my 33 and a half years as a pastor, I'm now seeing more and more time has to be spent on basics like that.
Yes.
We don't need innovation.
No.
The way forward is not in coming up with new ideas. I know that feeds academia, because you need to come up with more dissertations.
Right.
But the reality is, for the church, it has to be a move back to the very basic things, because the young people are not getting it.
No.
You know, and a lot of this will be taught by being caught.
Yes.
By them shadowing pastors, seasoned pastors, and biblically sound churches. And experiencing in that context, rather than drinking from a fire hydrant at seminary with all of this information being thrown
right
at you,
right,
and you're having such difficulty sorting it all out, when in fact, it's best sought out in the context of the local church. So we're,
yes,
back to the same biblical,
right,
model.
Right. And it seems to me like whenever the church begins to stray in doctrine, going into a more and more progressive or liberal view, it doesn't really start in the local church. It starts in academia.
Mm-hmm.
Or it starts in some denomination, you know, the leadership of some denomination.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to keep things back in the local church. Now, on that, I would like to ask you a question. Let's say that there was a young man listening who sensed a call to the ministry or had some idea that he was being called into the ministry. What kind of advice would you give him?
I treat a call to the ministry with the same format and seriousness that I deal with the call to salvation. Mm-hmm. Everybody that is called has to be vetted. And that's what God's local church is for.
Amen.
If you're called to salvation, trust me, the people of God know what a saved person looks like. These are the people who are to vet your calling and to take you under their wing and disciple you and guide you and to help you examine yourself. In the same way, if you're called to ministry, a solid local church must vet that call. And before you can move forward, you need their blessing and guidance. So that's the first thing. It cannot be just an individual thing where you're called and you're going, you know.
Yeah.
The people of God have a role in that, and it's a very serious role. And so I would want such a young person to be connected to a serious church and a serious pastor to assist them in the vetting of this experience that they said they had with God. Sometimes they're not qualified. They're not gifted. they're not serious about holiness. Mm? They haven't a passion for the loss. They're more thinking in professional categories.
Right.
And they need to be weeded out or guided in the right direction. And so without that vetting apparatus, you're really setting up the church for a disaster. And so I would want that young person to be plugged into such a vetting mechanism, which is the local church, and a serious eldership.
And I think, again, it goes back to having biblical elders. Because I've seen so many elders who take such a superficial view of ministry and such a superficial view of giving their blessing to someone going in the ministry, or a superficial view of ordination, not recognizing that not only do they participate in the blessing of that ministry they're ordaining that person, but also the sin. You know, and we really need a reformation among pastors with regard to two things, I believe. One is the true conviction that it is sola scriptura. That is what must guide us, nothing more, nothing less. And then something I'm always praying for myself, and we pray here at Heart Cry quite a bit, Lord, increase our fear of thee, that we would walk according to these commands that he set out with regard to his church. Well, before we go on to another question, we're going to take a small break here, and then I'd like to go on again to another question, because while you're here, I want to pull everything out that I can.
Okay.
All right, God bless. Mm-hmm.